Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Jolly. Thanks very much for downloading and listening. If you want to listen to my Times Radio show, Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, you'll be in very good company. We've just got our first listening figures. 250,000 people listen to the show. If you want to join them, and why wouldn't you, you can find us on DAB Smart Speaker on the iPhone app or at Times Top Radio. But here on the podcast, of course, you get the best bits of the show coming up. We read the small print of the budget and try and find the nuggets that you might have missed. That's coming up in just a moment. But first, it's our columnist panel. And of course, on a Thursday, it is Night at the Marriott. It's India Knight and James Marriott.
Morning, India.
Morning.
And James Marriott. Morning, James.
Good morning.
Have you ever heard that music before, James?
I have. Is it still on?
I think it's on Channel 5.
Yeah, I had a very strange friend at school who was obsessed with Neighbours. And when I used to go to his house after school, we'd have to watch it.
Were you ever a big Neighbours fan, India?
I was, actually. I think there was a phase that coincided with me being at home with one of the children when they were very small, and I kind of quite got into watching it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the feeling of the way. You seem quite anti-bagpipe, Matt.
Are you pro-bagpipes?
I am so pro-bagpipe. I can't hear a bagpipe without bursting into tears.
Really? Well, I am the same, but for different reasons. There we are. You see, I knew eventually I'd find somebody like bagpipe. I think they're fine. I quite like them if I get off the train in Edinburgh and there's someone playing the bagpipes. That's nice. The guy who stands on Westminster Bridge playing them every day is really annoying. And I think if your neighbour is playing them, that is quite annoying. And I just quite like the idea that what I like is there's someone who's learnt the bagpipes but is self-aware enough to know they're annoying to go down and annoy Insulate Britain. I know that people hate them. I hate them, but I'm going to learn the bagpipes just to annoy the glue people. anyway, that's not what we're here for. Let's talk about the budget, first of all. And I just wanted to get your take, really, on as not being sort of necessarily creatures of the Westminster Village. What's your sort of big takeaway on the budget and this sort of slightly schizophrenic Rishi Sunak saying, I'm a low tax, low spending, small state conservative who then embarks on creating the highest tax burden since the 1950s and the highest level of government spending since the 1970s? What's your take on it, India?
Well, I like the $150 billion on public services. I like the emphasis on skills and disabilities when it comes to health and education. I think Rachel Reeves said a slightly odd thing when she, in relation to the reducing the levy on short-haul flights, when she said bankers sipping champagne on short-haul flights will be cheering. I really don't think they will, because it comes to about £6 per person. So actually, the people who will be cheering are, I don't know, a family of six going to Spain next summer who are saving a 70-odd quid. Hold on, fuel duty, I think it's not very green, but I think it's probably quite a good thing because petrol prices are through the roof. I think, yeah, I mean, it is schizophrenic. I think there's quite a lot to quite like.
And I suppose that's the thing, isn't it, James, is that there's something for everyone. Unless probably if you're a bit green, which is obviously we should all be ahead of COP26, it's not very... And actually, there's been this sort of hint that Rishi Sunak isn't very green for a while. And this clearly is not the budget of someone who is desperate for COP26 to be a roaring success.
Yeah, exactly. The thing I sort of... The main thing that struck me about it was the way that there's sort of tides of economic history that seemed to kind of, you know, for the last sort of, you know, 70 years, we had the kind of, you know, the post-war sort of big state, then the sort of 1980s and the, you know, the shrinking of the state. And whatever your, I don't know, it just struck me that, you know, whatever your personal ideology, whatever you sort of say you think about how the economy should be run, you sort of, I don't know, those sort of larger tides of history, this kind of return to, you know, larger states, this kind of, you know, renewed interest in the idea that government should spend and should tax people. Sort of, I don't know, Rishi Sunak, for all his sort of personal beliefs, has, you know, ended up, you know, on this kind of tide of economic history that seems to be going in a particular direction. Just, it was very interesting because I'm not a close budget watcher, but I didn't expect it.
And it leaves Labour in a slightly tricky place, doesn't it, India? Because where do they go on this? Apart from saying, well, we'd spend a bit more. You know, they attack them on the universal credit. You know, they're actually doing the universal credit taper cut is something that Labour called for a few weeks ago. It's not giving back the £20 a week, which they took away, but it's doing some of that. And quite a lot of what they talked about, the Labour Party talked about, he has done. And it apart from saying, well, we'd spend a pound more, it's very difficult to get cut through on that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't really... Yeah, they're in a difficult place. They're in a difficult place. I think they can go big on the lack of greenness, but... As I was saying, I think ordinary people will be quite pleased about the fuel and flights announcement. So, yeah, difficult. What I'm really amazed by, which I only discovered this morning, thanks to a Thunderer column in today's paper, because I'm fascinated by Rishi Sunak's branding. Sorry, I know this isn't actually the actual budget,
but I'm
obsessed with his branding and his sort of sleekness. And I didn't realise that he and Liz Truss have, paid by the taxpayer, private sort of vanity photographers that follow them around.
Yeah.
What's that about? Has that always been a thing?
No. So if you remember, when David Cameron became Prime Minister, he tried to put a photographer on the sort of on the books. Actually, you know, the sort of the point they made was that it's quite good to be able to capture the things, what's, you know, going on behind the scenes. They've got one in the White House. I think they've got several in the White House, and you get all those sort of, you know, dramatic moments of Barack Obama on the phone or whatever it might be. And there was such a backlash back then in 2010. David Cameron U-turned on it because, you know, he was imposing austerity while hiring a photographer. Mm-hmm. And that was seen as a bit shameless. However, such things do not trouble Boris Johnson. And he's got not one, not two, but three photographers on the books who, as well as taking photos of the Prime Minister, they take photos of ministers when they're out and about. And I think the complaint about it is that it is... I think in America, the pool is still quite a big thing. And there are still photographers and journalists who go to everything, every single outing by the president. Whereas what happens here is Boris Johnson goes to a factory. We aren't told about it. Press photographers don't go. And so the only photos we get are of, you know...
The sort of
North Korean style. Everyone's laughing and clapping and all of that. And they don't see the Prime Minister, you know, putting his hand in a mangle or whatever it is that he shouldn't have been doing. So, yeah, and then, yeah, there was this great story in the Times earlier this week about how Liz Truss had sort of more photos than the whole of the cabinet put together taken in the last 6 weeks. And she's obviously trying to slightly rival Rishi Sunak's brand building.
Absolutely. It's really interesting.
Does it excite you, James?
It depresses me a bit because I used to think the one good thing about British, or one of the good things about British politics, was how incredibly unglamorous it was.
Yeah,
and if you're in American politics, you can stride around on stage and look incredibly important and glamorous, and, you know, it's very sort of aspirational. But, you know, British politics is all about people sort of, you know, looking a bit bored and sad, opening garden centres, you know, standing slightly awkwardly in classes full of children. And it was a sort of, I think it was a really healthy thing for politics that it never particularly looked glamorous, and always these people really did look like public servants. And I was struck watching the new Labour documentary in the BBC, actually, the kind of the sort of difference In tone of the government now, and this kind of this sort of photography thing plays into it, because Tony Blair and Gordon Brown always, in my perception, from this documentary, far more often seem to be on television, getting into embarrassing situations, confronting awkward questions, having awkward moments, and seem to be really sort of excruciated about it and bothered by it in a way that has sort of seems to have leaked away from politics now, and it's much more kind of imperial, official court photographers. It's all much more glamorous. Everything just rides above the head of anything, you know, the press or the public might say. I think that's a depressing development. I think politics should be unglamorous and sort of slightly sad looking.
I looked back, talking of sort of politics getting to, you know, it was better when it was slightly less glamorous. I went back, because this is how I, you know, spend my week. I went back through a whole load of old budget statements. And particularly Norman Lamont's, I think it was from 1991. And he, like, there was no sense of, like, Rishi Sunak was like he was hosting a game show yesterday. It was like,
yeah,
this is Dow, that's that. And Norman Lamont was like, he literally got up and said, like I suspect most chancellors, I've found the preparation of this, my first budget, very exciting. And that was the, you know, that was the whole sort of tone. And it was just a sea of grey men in grey suits. And this whole idea of the chancellor being the dull man in charge of the numbers. He was the nation's accountant.
Yeah.
And now he's the sort of, you know...
Yeah, whizzy game show host.
Yes,
with his
internet
in his
startup. Yeah. You know, yeah, it's a very strange...
Bad, yeah, thing. A bad thing. Bring back grey.
I'm afraid we need to move on. Mike's just messaged. There's a dire conversation taking place about political photo ops on Times Radio. It sounds like a sixth form discussion at best. That's very unfair. James hasn't started sixth form yet, so... Let's talk about your column instead, James.
Yes. So in my habit of tackling, I need to tackle smaller topics. But this week is on Genius, and
your own.
Although I don't know. Depends. In a few years' time, when my ego has sufficiently expanded, I'll be reporting.
Yeah,
well,
Mike will be in touch.
Mike is popping any delusions. I have about that. Yes. So this was about. I don't know, just think I'd noticed. I was thinking about the kind of ubiquity of Jesse Armstrong, Succession's chief writer, in various kind of being interviewed absolutely everywhere at the moment. And I was thinking how unusual it is to see the writer of a TV show in the newspapers, how kind of rarely we see that nowadays. And what a kind of change that represents from the fact that, you know, TV, which I think is probably, you know, the most kind of, at the moment, the most culturally prestigious, the most important, the most influential art form we have, these kind of prestige TV shows, how it's strange it is that they're run by armies of anonymous people, you know, producers, teams of script writers, all in the writer's room, compared to, I think, you know, sort of 40, 50 years ago when the big cultural art form was the novel, and we had these, you know, individual novelists who are kind of acknowledged publicly as like these important geniuses, things to say about society, all over the press, all over the media. And just what a kind of strange trend this is, which I think is a trend away from our kind of this kind of respect we used to have for individual genius and towards these kind of much more collaborative art forms. So I was thinking about video games, you know, it's a massively influential, massively wealthy industry. And, you know, I'm not sure I could name a single video game designer. I think probably a couple of people who are into it could, but we've kind of lost these like central cultural figures from our society, and everything I think now is sort of much more collaborative and anonymous. And I was slightly lamenting this.
And so the Jesse Armstrong is an example of a sort of, you know, the Succession is his genius.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
What do you think about this, India?
I think it's very true. I think it comes from the idea, as James says in his column, that everybody is as clever and interesting as everybody else. And, you know, in the case of novels, the idea that everybody has a book in them. I mean, maybe they have a book in them that would be interesting to their immediate family, but they certainly don't have a book in them that would be interesting to people as a whole. And I think also there's a very kind of British... The British have a strange relationship with genius, because I think that people are quite defensive. We don't really want, I mean, I quite want to say, wow, that person is amazing and I revere them. But I think generally there's a tendency to say, well, that person is amazing, but they're very lucky and they landed on their feet. And, you know, Jesse Armstrong, something, 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 I could probably do it in my sleep, a bit like Mike. So there's a kind of suspicion of outstanding talent. and that's been constantly eroded, I think, in the last few decades particularly. And there's the idea that anybody could really do anything in the right circumstances, which is a wrong idea, I think.
And it, I suppose it is part, is also that sort of, you know, particularly like the awards show, you know, awards ceremony season, where everyone has to thank everyone and then also, you know, acknowledge their privilege and their, you know, they, oh, well, you know, I've been very lucky for whatever reason. And, you know.
Yes, and to display amazing, unnecessary levels of humility.
Yes, you know. Exactly right. Well, you won't get any of that here. 250,000 people listen to this. It's quite extraordinary.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I know, it's exciting, but it's all down to the columnist panel, I think. That's definitely the key.
India Knight and James Marriott there, and you can read them in the Times and the Sunday Times every week. Get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, we take a deep dive into the small print of the budget.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now, let's take a look at some of the bits you might have missed from the budget.
Let's speak to our panel. We've got Kitty Usher, Chief Economist at the Institute of Directors and a former Economics Secretary of the Treasury in the Labour government. Morning, Kitty.
Morning.
There we are. Lovely stuff. Kitty's there.
Morning.
We've also got Mike Brewer, the Chief Economist at the Resolution Foundation. Morning, Mike.
Hello, Matt. Good to be with you today.
Henry Morrison is the Director of the Northern Powerhouse Partnership. Morning, Henry.
Great to join you, Matt.
And we've got Thomas Pope, who's Deputy Chief Economist at the Institute for Government. Hi, Thomas.
Good morning.
Lovely stuff. So what I thought we'd do is sort of pick through, I think you've all picked out slightly different bits of the budget, but feel free to chip in if you, particularly if you drastically disagree with something that someone has been saying, just to get your different taste. But let's start with you first of all, Kitty. And on the sort of the big picture, we do seem to have a Chancellor who says he's a low-tax, small-state Conservative who then goes on to expand the tax burden to the highest level since the 1950s. Government spending will be its highest level since the 1970s. And lots of people saying that this is the sort of budget that, you know, Gordon Brown could have delivered. What's your assessment on that, both as a... somebody, you know, Gordon Brown was your boss, of course, when you were in the Treasury. What's your assessment on making those two things match up, the ideology of it all?
Well, thanks, Matt. I think you've put your finger right on it. So the way I see it is back in March, when the economy was looking pretty desperate, the only way that the Chancellor at that time could make it look like he had a plan for this enormous rise in government debt to start coming down again was to basically pre-announce some really enormous tax rises a few years into the future. And he did that primarily by doing a massive U-turn on Conservative policy on corporation tax, where, you know, only 2 years ago they wanted to cut it to, you know, extraordinarily low levels, 17%. But he said back in March, actually, scrap that, we're going to raise it to 25% and also take a bit more money from income tax as well. Now, since then, we've actually had some really good news in that the economy is growing far faster and has recovered much better than we thought it would back in March. Now, of course, if the economy starts growing faster, then they get more tax receipts kind of naturally and are spending less on things like unemployment benefits kind of naturally. So he found himself, you know, in quite an extraordinary situation of having far more money than he thought he would, because he had all these tax rises he'd already announced and the economy was coming back. Now, he could have said, well, actually, we don't need to raise tax as much as we thought we would have to. And certainly that would have been welcome to business in particular. But he didn't. He said, well, actually, we're going to spend this. And so we've seen a budget with, you know, basically a complete reversal of George Osborne's austerity approach after the last economic shock of the financial crisis, but also a budget where the people who are going to be paying for it haven't started to pay for it yet. And so whilst it might feel all right at the moment, what we're worrying about is quite hefty tax hikes sort of on the horizon coming down at us, both for individuals, but also crucially for businesses who are the engines of our future growth. And we're a little worried that the growth forecasts sort of in 3 or 4 years' time are actually quite low as a result of a possible tailing off of investment from the private sector.
Call me cynical, if you like, Kitty, but do you think this is all basically setting up for a pre-election tax-cutting budget where the chance to be able to stand, oh, everything's going much better than I expected. I can now cut you know, some personal taxes, but possibly also some business taxes too, going into an election, and then he can claim that the, you know, Conservatives are then high spending but also low taxation. And what impact does that make then on, you know, from the Institute of Directors' perspective, like business trying to plan when, you know, taxes are going up and down based on sort of political whim rather than, you know, long-term economic strategy?
I think this is a really big problem. And what we're picking up from business at the moment is a sort of almost kind of Kafkaesque uncertainty about what government's going to do next. And if you think about it, if you're trying to decide around the boardroom table whether to spend money to invest for the medium term, whether that's, you know, your own profits if you have them, or shareholder funds, or even taking on debt to do so, you need to have certainty about what the overall policy framework is. And we've seen that that certainty basically collapse, and businesses are feeling very uncertain about the state of the economy at the moment. And of course, what you say is right, in that Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, has let it be widely known that he'd much rather be cutting tax than raising it. And I'm sure there's a political purpose behind that, because otherwise those parts of his party that think they've joined a low tax party would be rather bemused, and are rather bemused by their government being actually one of the highest tax governments that we've seen in living memory.
Okay, that's the picture from business. We'll come back to you in a sec, Kitty, I'm sure. Mike Brewer, Chief Economist at the Resolution Foundation. You've been looking at what this means for individuals, personal taxation, what's happening to benefits and so on, and crunching the numbers on where this will leave households compared to when Boris Johnson first became Prime Minister. And it's a pretty eye-watering figure. Explain what you've worked out.
Well, it follows on, yeah, very naturally from that the high tax state that we're moving to under Rishi Sunak. By 2026, according to the government forecasts, the tax burden will be up at 36% of GDP. That's a really, which will be 3 percentage points higher than when Boris Johnson took office as Prime Minister, which is an enormous change in just those 7 years. And that 3 percentage point increase in the tax burden is worth, we think, about £3,000 for each household in the country. I mean, you said a few minutes ago, Matt, that Rishi Sunak wants to be a high spend, low tax chancellor. Of course, that's impossible. But he also recommitted to fiscal rules that made it impossible. So he knows it's impossible. So what we're seeing here is that really at the moment, his what's happening is he's a high spending chancellor, and because of his fiscal rules, because he doesn't want to be fiscally profligate, he does want to be able to at least say that we are the party of sound public finances. If he's going to be a high spending chancellor, and whether that's his instinct or the prime minister's, you know, I couldn't say, but if he's going to be a high spending chancellor, he also has to be a high tax chancellor, and that means tax burden going up to record levels.
And I suppose if it'd be one thing if the taxes are going up, if the economy was booming, and crucially, we were moving to the high-wage economy that the Prime Minister talks about, then that would possibly be OK. But your assessment is that in real terms, wages are going to fall next year, and there's just no sign of some sort of surge towards becoming this high-wage economy.
That's absolutely right, yes. So the Chancellor began his speech with the good news from the economic outlook, but that all just applies to this year. So yes, this year has been good for the UK. We have not suffered as much from the pandemic as we might have thought, and the OBR think that the damage done by the pandemic is not as severe as it could have been. But still, the long run prognosis for average earnings for household income is incredibly poor. So yes, next year in 2022, we expect average weekly earnings to fall in real terms. That's basically because inflation is just going to be so high. But what's more worrying is the longer run prognosis. 5 years out, the OBR think that average income is going to be growing by just 1.3% in real terms every year. And this used to be more like 2% a year. Now, that's not much of a difference. But if this happens every year, year after year after year, you just get we're just basically not becoming as prosperous as we might be expecting. And that ultimately is hitting people's living standards.
And you might say, well, you know, people are well off, you know, people like me could probably pay a bit more tax, and that would, you know, that's not going to sort of push me over below the breadline. But you've been looking at some of the impacts on some of the poorest households as well. And although there's some changes to universal credit, you've looked at if you combine lots of things, taking away the £20 a week that was put in place during the pandemic, some of the extra support and so on, you still think that on the average, the lowest, the poorest families will still be worse off overall?
Yeah, so coming into the budget, we're all very aware of the cost of living crunch this winter. OBR confirmed that inflation next year will likely be 4%. But of course, the cost of living crunch for low-income families was partly of the Chancellor's making, because earlier this month he removed the £20 a week uplift universal credit. Now, although yesterday we saw the Chancellor put back in £2 to £3 billion into universal credit, that is not enough to offset the £20 a week cut that he put in earlier this month. So in particular, if you're not working and on universal credit, so maybe you're sick or disabled, maybe you have a young child, maybe you're still looking for work, then right now that cut in the taper is no use to you at all. You're just hit by the £20 a week loss, and you've got fuel bills, energy bills going up this winter.
So that's the picture in terms of personal finances. Mike Brewer, Chief Economist of the Resolution Foundation. We're going to take a look at what it all means for levelling up and the winners and losers in the Whitehall battle of the spending review. We're taking an in-depth look at the small print of the budget here on Times. It's Matt Shawley in association with Mastercard Strive, empowering small businesses for a digital future.
Mariella Frostrup, this afternoon from 1 on Times Radio.
Does the thought of revisiting old diaries send a shiver down your spine? For years, Dame Joan Collins kept a sporadic voice diary. Years later, and she's collating these candid and often humorous memories in a new memoir, My Unapologetic Diaries. We'll ask her why in our big interview. Travel expert Ben Clatworthy will help us break down the government's decision to cut domestic air passenger duty days before COP26. And we'll be previewing the newest films, including The Rescue, that and all the latest news, views and interviews.
Mariella Frostrup, this afternoon from 1 on Times Radio.
Matt Chorley on Times Radio with Strive UK from Mastercard, empowering small businesses for a digital future. Find out more at mastercard.co.uk/strive.
And Mariella will be here in about 10, 15 minutes for the coffee break. Although we're not having coffee this morning, we're going to have some fizz. You'll find out why just after 11:30. All fizz, of course, which is cheaper as a result of the budget, because the Chancellor cut the duty on it. Look, let's turn our attention to levelling up, one of the big policy priorities of the government. Henry Murison is the director of the Northern Powerhouse Partnership. It's right on the front line of the levelling up agenda. Morning, Henry, again.
Morning, Matt.
What was in it for the levelling up agenda? And I mean, the Northern Powerhouse was very much a sort of the baby of George Osborne. Rishi Sunak sort of torched the sort of Osborne era of austerity and so on. Is the Northern Powerhouse still alive and well? And what does levelling up? Are we any close to working out what levelling up actually means in practice?
I think there's probably more continuity around the approach to regional disparities actually under this government than in any other area. So apart from the rebrand of the Northern Powerhouse levelling up, there is quite a lot of consistency. So the devolved funds that Rishi Sunak was adding to, those are all going directly to metro mayors, both Conservative ones like Ben Houchen on the Tees Valley, but also to Labour politicians. And that kind of spirit of kind of working with your political opponents. And you had Andy Burnham on the TV and radio at the weekend sounding very positive about the budget, right? And what the government was doing, particularly in that specific area. So you are getting back to that sort of almost kind of cross-party consensus, at least between civic leaders and the government, which was very much the hallmark of the Osborne era. I think in terms of the detail, I mean, the levelling up fund that's been announced is a more traditional kind of Whitehall beauty pageant. So you had to put in your bids, and it is, I'm sure there are reasons why some of those bids were successful and didn't, that isn't entirely about politics. But one of the ones that was a bit of a shocker was Billingham didn't get any regeneration money. It's, if anyone who's not familiar, a town in the northeast, but nearby Yarm and Eaglescliffe that are significantly more prosperous and leafy did get money for their town centres. So I think there is a challenge for the government, which is that if they had been more willing outside of transport funding to trust the mayors and give them more of the funds rather than run these big national competitions, the money's used more rationally. And the economic problem, which obviously is Kitty's department, but I'll freestyle a little bit, is that if you spend money on lots of little projects, even though I actually think some of the projects are really valuable, the Bury Market, where the Chancellor was today, is absolutely a driver of footfall in Bury. It's a good project. The other projects in Bury that the council put forward with their MPs, good projects. But you could have given that money to Greater Manchester and let Andy Burnham fund the market in Bury. You don't, as the Chancellor, have to pick between different towns in Teesside or particularly in a place like Greater Manchester. At the time, we sort of said to the Chancellor when he first announced this fund, at least where there are metro mayors, give them an allocation and just let them allocate it between projects, because it took the government longer to allocate the money than they gave people to bid for it. And the problem with that is it's just irrational. And I'm in Sheffield today, the leader of Rotherham next door made that point. And he had a great project that was funded. One of his, Wentworth Woodhouse, which is a great old country pile out in South Yorkshire, a great asset for the nation. But one of his other projects didn't get funded. And the point is, it should really be up to Dan Jarvis and the leader of Rotherham, right, to work out what they do with the scarce resources that might be available for South Yorkshire. I'm not sure that the Chancellor, kind of getting the names wrong this morning, of Burnley and Bury Market has done much for the idea that whether it's the Chancellor or an official in his department, that somebody in those positions should be making these detailed, granular decisions. I think we went to the trouble of electing these mayors. They should do it.
I was going to say, do you think that this is politics? That Dan Jarvis in South Yorkshire, Andy Burnham in Greater Manchester are Labour politicians. And what Rishi Sunak wants to do is go to these places, once he's learnt the names of them, turn up with a big cheque and his taxpayer-funded photographer, and they can take some nice pictures for his Instagram, and he can say that he's paid for this, that and the other, rather than having, you know, Andy Burnham or Dan Jarvis taking credit for it. Do you think that's a bit of what's going on, and that actually politics is sort of overriding sort of economic sense?
I mean, the thing is, though, they did do that for transport, right? So they got it right for some bits of the budget, but they've got it wrong for others. And I think your challenge is probably a fair one, Matt, which is that the government, I don't think, has quite understood yet that Northerners in particular, at least from the Northern Powerhouse, are not necessarily interested in each individual scheme. They're interested in whether they're getting more prosperous, whether there are more jobs in their local area, whether they think their kids will be able to get a better paid job when they leave school or university or college. And actually, I think whether you're a Red Wall voter or a punter anywhere in the north of England, I think you're probably pretty astute about what the economic chances are for you and your family. And I think you're more interested. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure those people were more interested in things that would actually drive up productivity. And the challenge with doing the sort of announcement thing is that it naturally forces you to do short-term, easy-to-deliver things that can be done before the next election things. Whereas, in fact, actually, we haven't had as much of the replacement for EU funding as we were promised. The Shared Prosperity Fund is looking pretty light. It's on a trajectory towards what we got from the EU, but it's nowhere near that. And lots of these northern areas, lots of these red wall areas, were absolutely big recipients of of money from the European Union, South Yorkshire, Liverpool City region. These places got a lot of EU cash. And the problem for the government is if you've actually withdrawn that money, which was paying for things that would actually drive up productivity, people will start to notice that. And I think that is a real problem for this government.
OK, so that's the picture with levelling up and the funding of local government and so on. But what about the broader, the spending review? We had a budget and a spending review which sets spending for the coming years. Thomas Pope, Deputy Chief Economist at the Institute for Government, has been going through all of the spreadsheets and the tables and seeing how all the money adds up. Thomas, in terms of, first of all, the sort of the headline claim from Rishi Sunak that spending is going up in real terms for every government department. Is what he said in the House of Commons. Is that quite right? And how, given, after a decade of austerity of one sort or another, how significant is it then that if it go, the spending is going up?
That claim does pretty much stack up. It's pretty close with a couple of departments. You can see the Treasurer sort of moved 50 million here or there right at the end just so that they can make that claim. But the big picture on this spending review is that it is really generous. It's more than 3% a year in real terms for the next 3 years. Most of that money is actually coming in next year. So it's really front loaded. And that's a good idea, given that we want public services to be able to recover from COVID, deal with backlogs quickly. And really the bizarre thing on public spending, certainly at a higher level, is that just a few weeks ago, the Treasury was continuing with a pretense that there was going to be this really tight spending settlement that would have meant real terms cuts for lots of departments next year. And really, that was never going to be deliverable, given what's happened in the last 10 years, given the impact of COVID and given the government's commitment. So really, that was all a bit farcical, but it did allow the Chancellor to announce very big increases yesterday.
We should point out that in some cases, the big increase, particularly on education spending, increase in education spending. But people are pointing out that in real terms, it's just taking us back to where we were in 2010.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, I think you can start, if you start your analysis in this year, 2021, you're going to see very big increases if you account for, more than 20% cuts in many departments between 2010 and 2020. Some departments are sort of getting back towards that pre-crisis level. So I think that education per pupil spending is just about back at 2010 levels. The Justice Department, they got a generous settlement yesterday, but they're still quite a long way below their 2010 level and will still be by 2024. And even being flat in real terms over 15 years isn't a great outcome, really. We would have expected to have done much better than that. So absolutely the important context here for the next 3 years is the 12 years or so that have preceded it. But nonetheless, this is still generous increases, should allow public services to deal with COVID. I think one of the challenges that will come down the track is that because most of the spending increases are coming in next year, after that, there aren't really many increases. And people that are good for lobbying for more public spending will no doubt be pointing out in 2023, hold on, there's not a very big increase coming this year because there was a very big increase the year before. So I suspect that's another challenge the Chancellor will have to deal with down the line. But right now he can sort of enjoy the fact that for the first time in a long time, public services are actually getting the sorts of money that people have been calling for.
Is this a sort of recognition that during the early stages of austerity, the sort of 2010 to 2015, we were told, Theresa May said, yes, you can cut police numbers and it doesn't affect crime. You can take money out of education, but results still do. Is this actually, Rishi Sunak won't say this in the dispatch box, but it is proof that if you do cut the funding, that services are less good. And so you, over a long period of time, a gradual erosion, you can only take a bit of money out and immediately nothing happens. But over time, there is an erosion. And then the pandemic hits, highlights lots of those shortfalls, and you have to try to stuff the money back in again.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. So we do an annual performance tracker, which looks at the performance of nine different public services kind of across the piece. And what you could see is that those first couple of years of austerity, you could kind of get away with it. There was probably a bit of fat that you could trim and performance didn't really suffer. But then from really the mid-2010s onward, I would say that even before the pandemic, really the sort of impact of lower funding on public service performance was pretty clear. But that perhaps has been exposed even more in the pandemic, and there are the additional pressures from the pandemic. So yeah, I think, it's good news in a way that when we spend more money on public services, we get more out of them. But that does also mean that when you take a lot out, you're going to get worse as well. And I think actually across the board, in many ways, what Sunak did yesterday was a bit of a reverse Osborne. You know, he's the UC taper used to be at 55 when Universal Credit first came in. Osborne increased it to 63. Now it's fallen again. Per pupil spending now going back to 2010. Talk from Sunak yesterday about spending more on libraries and other local spending, which was cut pretty savagely under Osborne. So while he's retained that commitment to sort of sustainable public finances, fiscal discipline, he's doing it in a completely different way. He's decided actually we need to increase spending, and that, as we've already mentioned, means much higher taxes.
Okay, just finally, then I just want to ask you all, because you know that everything's still up in the air right now, and you know it's the morning after the budget and all of that. Looking a week ahead or a month in the future or whatever, what will this budget be remembered for? Is it all good news, or are there sort of some gremlins hidden at the bottom? Just sort of in a sentence, if you like, what do you think the budget will be remembered for, or the thing that we need to keep an eye on in the coming months? First of all, Kitty Usher from the Institute of Directors.
Absolutely no change in the massive hike in business taxation, both national insurance contributions and corporation tax. 2020, that's what 2021 is about, as far as particularly smaller firms are concerned.
Lovely stuff. Mike Brewer from the Resolution Foundation.
I think what will come back to bite the Chancellor is he didn't do anything to solve the energy crisis this winter. So no VAT cut, no direct help for those suffering with energy bills. He may regret that.
Henry Morrison from the Northern Powerhouse Partnership.
So he signalled that the integrated rail plan would be soon. That's the thing that brings the HS2 and Northern Powerhouse Rail decisions. Clearly they have longer term financial costs, relatively short amounts of money in the near term. Government will have a real challenge to prove that levelling up is credible if that's not ambitious. And at the moment, there isn't clarity yet on what will be in that plan.
And finally, Thomas Pope from the Institute for Government.
I think I'd agree with Mike. I think actually there was very little on the cost of living crisis yesterday. And as real wages start to fall over the next 6-12 months, I think we may look back at this and think, why didn't he do a bit more?
Well, that's it for this episode of Red Box. If you've enjoyed it, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. Maybe even leave us a rating because it helps with the mumbo jumbo charts. We release an episode every day, Monday to Thursday, featuring the best bit of my Times Radio show. You can listen to the whole thing Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. It's available on DAB online via smart speaker or on the Times Radio app. And if you want to read more about all of the stories we've been discussing, then go to times.radio/subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.